Welcome to BridgeEd, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector. Well, hello everyone. I'm delighted once again to be joined by Maria Arper, MBE, who is the founder of the Centre for Peaceful Solutions. And we're going to be embarking on what I think will be a fascinating conversation about this whole area of human flourishing, what it means to be human, what it means to enact our humanity in its fullest sense, and all of this in the context of the age of AI, which is most definitely upon us and will be upon us for some time to come. So sit back and listen and see what you think. Well, welcome back again, Maria. It's good to be able to talk again, especially after our last fascinating conversation. And as we've kicked a few ideas around for this one, we really, I think, together alighted upon this whole question of human flourishing in the age of AI being a very central topic for education and society in general to consider. So that's where we're going to go. And we might even keep on topic this time.
Well, who knows? Who knows, Ian? It's always a delight to have a chat. And, you know, sometimes it's good to just see where the conversation goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I was well up for that myself. So, I mean, just as a starter, when, you know, if somebody came into to a conversation with you and started talking about human flourishing and its context in the age of AI, as AI becomes such a big part of everyone's life, I'm curious what comes up for you as people say that to you.
Oh, it's so vast. I think, you know, firstly, you know, am I terrified of AI? You know, do I think it's a good thing? Is there a dark side to it? So first, I have to kind of get over the noise, you know, the inner noise that comes up when something new is about to take over society. And then I start going to, if we use it correctly, if we can stay in our humanity and see AI as a tool that supports humanity, then it could be a really good thing. I mean, it could take a lot of unnecessary stress, a lot of unnecessary work out of things that are quite laborious. And then there's that bridge between, yes, and how do we do that constructively in a way that doesn't just turn us into stupid, dumb recipients of machine knowledge. And I don't even know if I'm using the right jargon, but I suppose that's what comes up for me. And then can AI, can a machine, can it ever replicate our humanity? Can it replicate? I reckon it will get close. My worry is that it fools us into believing it can.
And that's a really interesting point that you raised there. And I think, so first of all, the repeated word in what you just said was definitely humanity. And it's about how humans can retain and connect with their essential humanity as the world progresses. And the ease with which AI can convince you that it is human and fool you into thinking it is human. I mean, there have been tragedies, there have been suicides and so on, but there have also been, you know, many, many scams where people have fallen for something. So, you know, I think that essential question of how can we not just retain but magnify our humanity as human beings feels to me like a really important part of that. And on this whole area, then we talked last time about we need to teach two things: community and knowledge to young people, in order that they can go into the outside world, into a world that is undeniably much more changeable and much more volatile and much more difficult to predict than it's ever been before. And that's absolutely not in question, I don't think. For me, I feel that education has been bombarded by a ridiculously non-circular argument, a sort of a series of three non sequitur statements that have been somehow put together, and they go something like this. So firstly, young people leave school or university and they don't have the skills that make them employable. They're not useful in the old human capital model of education. They're no longer useful in the workplace, one. The second statement is the jobs of the future haven't been invented yet, which has been repeated so many times it's sort of attained the status of fact and no one's ever really questioned it. And for sure, for many, many years, the workplace has changed and so on, but maybe not quite as much as some people think. And set against that, you've obviously got a big change in the availability of entry-level white-collar jobs that used to be the mainstay of the traditional system of you go to school, you get grades, the grades take you to university, you train, and then you enter professions where there is a career ladder, and that is definitely changing. So there's your second statement is the jobs of the future haven't been invented yet, and the third statement is therefore schools need to educate kids for the jobs of the future. Well, if those three don't fit together, they don't fit together at all. I think it's a much better goal for us in education to be thinking about, well, how can we enable young people to go into the world, into a world that is more changeable, more volatile, more unpredictable, and to be able to thrive and flourish in that unpredictability, to have the frameworks to make good ethical decisions and good decisions about their own life, their own future, that lead to fulfillment, that lead to purpose, etc., etc. That it feels to me, just as you were saying that, this essential question of humanity, how do we connect with and magnify our humanity, seems to be a pretty crucial part of this.
I'm sort of taken aback by the enormity of what you just shared, because it turns everything on its head. If we really want to address those issues, then we're going to have to come into everything from completely different doorways to the ones we have been coming in. And so then teaching then becomes about living in the present, because a lot of what we are taught is to be working towards something in the future that we may or may not get. And, you know, I often reflect on the fact that when I used to run private practice, I often had a heart for people that would come who life just hadn't delivered for them. And even worse, for people where they'd done everything they were supposed to do and it still hadn't delivered. So something about living in the present is for me an essential skill. Being able to work with unpredictability and uncertainty and still love yourself and still love yourself and be confident. And then an understanding of resources. What resources do we have? And how are we going to deploy them? And, you know, then you come into ethics and morals and sharing and humanity and kindness. You know, I'm not going to get political about things like climate change and all the rest of it. At the end of the day, there's some resources. How are we using those resources so it isn't a scramble, you know, winner takes all competition? And the only way I can see forward with that is we must get out of the competitive mindset and into the collaborative mindset. And the way I like to talk about that is there are going to be many unanswered questions. There's going to be many opinions. There's going to be many arguments, academic, physical, you know, human arguments. And my question is, and scrambling over resources. And my question is, how do we continue to love each other while we have those conversations? Because at the moment, disagreement turns you into an enemy.
Yeah, and that really, I think, has been lived out so so obviously in recent years. And you could pick any sphere in the world, but if we take education, where conversations about different things that we do have been quite binary for some time. I mean, there's the self-styled trads versus the progressives a few years ago that's kind of dwindled away a little bit, and now, you know, there are other examples of similar, but it becomes almost tribal, where, you know, in believing in or about one thing, you have to ergo be in opposition to the other. And it feels to me like actually the whole business of being human is more complicated and more subtle than that, and so on. And wondering whether that resonates with you in the same way.
Absolutely. It's an interesting thing, isn't it, that we test kids, we test adults, you know, you're always on some sort of bloody performance thing or other. And we don't give prizes for collaboration. We don't actually, there is no test or measurement that can be defined, you know. I mean, yeah, maybe we'll honour somebody at some award thing or whatever, but we don't have a thing that says, actually, your ability to collaborate with so many people and to bring something together really well, where you produced harmony and you went through adversity with the least amount of human suffering, where are the prizes for that? And for me, that seems to be the essential next step.
Yeah, interesting, very interesting. It reminds me of teaching IB biology, where a part of the whole the course, a part of the syllabus, a part of the scheme of work was the groupful project, where they would work together on something. And admittedly, it's only a small part, but there was at least something there, and something that's maybe completely absent from quite a lot of education systems.
So that's really interesting that it even existed. My kids did the IB as well, which I was really happy about, and they were really happy with. Yeah. But, you know, it's a small part. It's like that's the breadcrumbs. You know, that needs to be a significant shift in how we are going to be together in an ever-changing world.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings up stuff that's within this concept of being human, to do with connection, to do with relationships, and those things which are essentially a part of being human. We have here the wonderful privilege of working with with Michael Stevenson, who spent the last few years, many years actually, working at the OECD. And the OECD have just published their framework for human flourishing, which is the fruits of Michael's work over the past few years. He's now founding director of the Wellington Institute for Human Flourishing. And some of the words that you've just used and that we've just kicked around a little bit are really heavily relied upon in Michael's framework. I think it's really instructive that the OECD, which, let's face it, has powered a lot of educational thinking in right across the world because of the PISA rankings. And what they are looking to do now is to create a new paradigm in education, where what we're really looking at is human flourishing, rather than the slightly more clear and maybe bold metrics of how well the kids do at the age of 15 in maths and science and reading. So this is a really exciting time for us. And you know, I'm going to take the conversation, if I may, into a slightly different realm. As you know, I'm a coach and a coach trainer, and a massive part of that is understanding self, understanding the values that we hold, and how we can live a life that is in accordance with our values and so on. And it feels to me like a really big part of enabling people to not just love self and to appreciate self, but to appreciate the connections with others and so on, really comes down to that opportunity to explore and understand who we are and what we stand for and what's important to us. It feels to me like society in general, but education in particular, has been incredible at asking what you're going to do. It's all about doing. But what prefaces that is who we are. And in this whole balance of the being and the doing is massive. You could do loads of things that are maybe sound good to somebody else, but if they're not in alignment with who you are, they're really, it's really not going to work for you. So that is a very rambly way of getting to the point of, well, if we are going to educate for flourishing, what needs to be there in terms of this, you talked about how can we love ourselves? What needs to be there to help people do that?
So first of all, good role models.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think the first iteration of this where the role models haven't actually shifted paradigm themselves is going to be the most difficult kind of transition, because if we are trying to be role models, but we haven't done that inner work ourselves and we don't know who we are and we've been so conditioned, you know, like, what do we think success is? What do we think depression is? What do we think relationships are?
Yeah.
You know, so we have to challenge ourselves first to know what on earth it is we want to be role models of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that sort of starts there for me. And how are we going to have those conversations in the debate model of conversation that we're so good at using? And how do we, you know, what I say is, how are we going to put it down and start again? Let's put it down and start again.
Yeah.
You know, this is what happens in you know, mediation sessions.
Yeah.
You know, two people come in, they're entrenched. You know, obviously, by the time you're mediating, there's some kind of entrenched dispute.
Yeah.
And much earlier on, we could have said,
yeah,
you know, what's the trajectory of this?
Yeah, yeah,
if we
yeah.
carry on in this vein, what is the trajectory?
Yeah, yeah.
How do we put it down? How, you know, I've got this phrase, this isn't the conversation I meant to have. Can we start again, please?
Yeah.
I think we could change the world in that one line.
Yeah.
If we could catch ourselves early enough.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So there's something about the role models. And what I referred to in our last discussion, which was who are the wisdom keepers?
Yeah.
Because they're not necessarily the same people who are the gatekeepers. They're not necessarily the same
True.
People. They're not necessarily the same people. I mean, you know, one of the things that's been really eroded is the idea of eldership. Because, you know, at my age now, because I don't really get the technology, I mean, I can talk about it and I can use it, but I don't really get it in any kind of big enough way. My eldership is trashed as a grandparent, as a wisdom keeper.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell the young people what they should expect and how they can prepare for it.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount here that we're losing that I think we need to regain.
Yeah. And it strikes me that we need to regain it in a slightly different way to what we did have, because probably for many, many years, the value of eldership was that the elders could predict what was going to happen
to
the younger generations. And therefore, there was real value in that wisdom. That was, it was as much prized by the young people as it was valued by the rest of society. And maybe there's a different form of wisdom that we need to prize in that way.
Well, I go back to Indigenous knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned, I spent some time with a group of people called the Wabanaki people in North America. And one of the things that they really impressed was, I mean, we went there to share some dialogue roadmap, but we were really clear this was a reciprocal, because there were things we needed to learn.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they talked about is decisions are made with seven generations in mind. You don't take a decision based on making a quick buck. You make a decision based on how will this affect seven generations going future. Well, we've lost that. We don't do that. We build businesses to sell them. I mean, who builds a business to pass on to your children anymore?
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
And you know, we said we weren't going to get political, and we won't. But but most political systems are predicated on, you know, making decisions that make me more likely to get re-elected in the next 1, 2, 3 years.
Yes, let alone seven generations.
Yeah, so there's a massive difference there.
So if you're thinking of seven generations ahead, you're asking yourself, should I cut this tree down?
Yeah.
You're asking yourself, if I build on this piece of land am I going to create a movement that's going to shift the water? And so we don't take that kind of time anymore. We've become so good at, you know, what I call the business part of a human transaction. So the business part of a human transaction, you know, is the contract, the curriculum, the whatever, you know, there's a business part, the divorce, the whatever. And then alongside that is how I feel about it and what the energy is around it. And so we've speeded that up, and this brings me back to AI, which will speed it up even more, but that takes us away from the consideration, understanding the shift in energy, like the tide goes in and out. It doesn't happen suddenly. Like the spring doesn't turn into summer overnight. There's a gradual process. And so what worries me is how we're separating our humanity from its connection to nature and the land and the you know, the environment.
And what if AI were able to free up much more bandwidth to really focus on that, on that key human element of the energy of a where a person is right now, where a relationship is right now, where a group is right now. You know, when we walk into a classroom, there is an energy of that classroom that that teachers are really, if they allow themselves to be cognizant of it, they immediately connect with it. What about if AI were able to free up the time, the headspace, the bandwidth to really connect with that?
Well, it might get there, you know. Who knows? It might well get there, and it might, I mean, we may be extinct, you know. We humans may be extinct, we may be on our way out. I don't, you know, I don't know. It's a possibility, like anything's a possibility. In the meantime, the issue that I have is that AI was, I mean, it sort of didn't use human conversations and, you know, draw from everything that we've already done to kind of feed it so it could then build its own intelligence, in inverted commas, and then decide how it wanted to be. It's going to be a hell of a job to turn that ship round from the competitive debate, right, wrong, you know, black and white kind of life, domination culture, as I call it, hierarchical structure that that's as by default fed it to learn. Because what, you know, if I could sort of scrub it all out and start again, I would say, look, we need to build it over here, and it needs to learn humanity and our values and our needs and what happens and our energetic forces, that, and maybe it needs to accept that it's got a long way to go before it can even get close to that. Am I making sense, or am I talking complete rubbish? Sorry.
Definitely not.
I feel I think I kind of immersed myself in
there
this.
There's a really alive fear for an awful lot of people that, that, you know, AI is understandably based upon what it is, what its knowledge base is populated with. And that's what you're referring to. And you said something, I think, really insightful there about, so how do you, in, you know, day-to-day work and the way that you work, you just interact with people, how do you bring values and needs to the surface for people?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, because there are a couple of things. So firstly, there's our use of language.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we live in the right, wrong, judgmental debate, you know, everything has to be labelled and diagnosed and put in a box. When we live in that way, we use language in a very particular way. And then when we, on top of that, use threat to motivate people, because there's always someone further up the food chain who can ruin your career or punish you in some way or publicly shame you or humiliate you, you know. So basically underlying the motivation to act comes from fear, guilt or shame. When we treat people like that, we use language in a very particular way. And so the first thing we can do is change our use of language and come back to the heart, come back to our soul quest, come back to and get out of thinking. Because you see, I believe that thinking is completely overrated. When, And I know that for a lot of people, that's going to sound absolutely outrageous. But thinking is something, it's just a tool. Mm. It's just a tool like any other tool. And it has its place, but we have been dominated by thinking. Mm. Our humanity has been overshadowed by, you know, the use of I think this and I think that. Mm. I'm thinking about overthinking, analysing everything. Mm. You know, reducing everything down to a rational argument or a sense of logic. But, you know, at the other end of that continuum, you know, you have, you know, logical thinking. And then at the other end of that spectrum is mysticism. Mm. And we seem to have forgotten all about that and dismissed it.
Mm.
And, you know, I can only talk about energy, frequencies, the soul, if I call it quantum physics, which defeats the whole object.
So to lob a devil's advocate thing in for a moment, the cognitive science advocates who, and that has, let's be honest, has been an extremely valuable understanding of the science of learning, the neurobiology of the brain, and so on. So some brilliant work has undoubtedly helped the education system to teach things better to young people over the last, I mean, definitely it's been a big thing for the last 20 years or so in some countries, fewer in one or two other countries. There's almost nothing that all of the cognitive science research agrees on. And all of the biology of learning research agrees on. But if there is one thing, it is that either hard thinking causes learning, or learning is the residue of hard thought, or so that it's recycled in different ways, but it's basically the same thing. And pretty much everyone agrees on that. So I hear what you're saying about thinking is overrated. And if learning is the residue of hard thought, what's the balance here between the value of thinking and the downside of thinking?
So if we're using the tool of thinking in a very specific container, and everybody's agreed this is the 2 hours where we're switching on thinking, then absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
But we need to know how to switch it off.
Yeah.
I need to know how to say, okay, well, we've done that 1 hour of intense thinking, and I'm going to do another hour of intense thinking to do the homework or you know, whatever it is. But in between time, I need to go into my heart, because once upon a time, the heart was thought of as the center. We were heart led. It was that was the belief, and the brain was just thought of as the air conditioning system.
Mm.
So it's about balance.
Yeah.
That's what it is for me. There's no one thing that's bad or whatever. Yeah. I just said thinking's overrated.
Yeah.
Because in the world I inhabit now, where I can, you know, and again, this is going to sound to some people very radical or out of their comfort zone, but, you know, I can walk into a room and feel the energy.
Mm-hmm.
I can tune in to a collective unconscious, which means I don't need to pre-think anything. I don't need to come with assumptions.
Yeah.
In fact, the more I walk into a room with some sort of innocence and naivety, the more open I am to the people around me.
Mm. And that feels really, really fundamental here, that if we can let go of assumptions, leave judgments at the door, be 100% present in whether it's just an interaction with one person or interaction with many, and to connect with the energy of that, you've got a hell of a lot better chance of meeting people where they are.
Absolutely.
And you know, I think one of your teachings that, you know, when I go back a few years when I did the whole dialogue roadmap training with you over 6 days, I think it was.
It's a year now.
Well, I must have been a quick learner then. Maybe I was thinking hard. But you know, there's something there about, like, really truly, by truly meeting people where they are, you're able to have a much, much better chance of them feeling heard, and a much, much better chance of enabling their values and needs to come to the surface and be articulated in a way that is often quite revelatory So that was really powerful what you said then.
Yeah, so for me it's about walking in, if other people are involved, which invariably other people are involved, and we walk into a space, first question is, how are we going to co-create being together?
Yeah, yeah.
And that requires us to let go of power dynamics.
100%, yeah.
And then, of course, in a lot of organisations, that's practically impossible.
Mm. And it's positively avoided in quite a lot of places. because what you've just described there is how are we going to be together?
Mm.
How are we going to co-create a way of being? How are we going to be together? How do we need to be together? It's all about being. But rules are always a list of do's and don'ts. Do this, do this, do this. Don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And the problem with any list of rules is, well, yes, it's about compliance, but there's also always a loophole somewhere. There's always,
that's right.
Always one you've forgotten.
Well, because you see, the whole point of having rules, and rules then goes into enforcement. For me, it's common agreements.
Yeah.
What are the agreements that we can make where we can operate and create some kind of safety and a few boundaries and, things like confidentiality and not crossing certain lines and all those things which we all need so we could create some common agreements, because rules are supposed to serve life.
Mm-hmm.
And where we've gone is life is now serving the rules. That's the wrong way round.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all these people waiting to catch people breaking rules with enforcement.
Yeah, there was a wonderful piece written on LinkedIn. Really is a product of two people. So Shane Leaning, who's someone we've done some work with, an organizational coach based in China, and also Sam Gibbs, who's the Director of Education for Greater Manchester Education Trust. Both brilliant people. We've worked with them a lot through the festivals and so on. And this idea that most systems of surveillance are designed to catch people doing things wrong, rather than starting from a belief that, well, everyone's trying to do the right thing. There seems to be a really fundamental failing there of how we support each other in society.
So my daughter went to boarding school. Both of my kids went to boarding school. And my daughter came home one weekend. She was in sixth form, where they didn't have to wear the uniform. They had to wear like a business suit.
Mm.
But the blouse was very short.
Mm.
And so she's carrying one bag of books and one bag with a laptop in it.
Mm.
And what would happen is the blouse would work its way out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decided, the school decided, that they all had to carry a uniform card. And if their uniform looked unkempt, they got some sort of, poisonous mark, against them. And and she was so observant about this, because she came home and said, what I really hate about this is that the starting point is I don't want to look nice, presentable and tidy. The starting point is that I want to flout the rules and that I want to do this deliberately. Instead of how can we help this to be better?
That has sparked off all sorts of things for me, as I'm sure you can imagine. And really, reverting to one of the things I talked about earlier with Dougie, our son, one of the things we learned on the Sunrise program, which was this wonderfully transformative way of forming connection with Dougie and with any autistic kid, was this actually taking the belief that everyone's doing the best they can with whatever they've got in that moment.
Mm.
It might not look that way, but if you can get out of judgment a little bit, and just, when somebody reacted in a way to Dougie's behaviour, which might have been a bit challenging to them or whatever, they're doing the best they can in whatever with what they've got in that moment, and that's so counter to the assumptions that most people make that like your daughter said, they are making an assumption that I don't want to look
presentable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's an interesting way to tackle compliance and behaviour is to start with the idea that, you've got to catch people.
And
for me, there are much better quality conversations, much better quality. Mm. I mean, when I go into schools, sometimes I do these trainings and I'm going to be with students for 3 days, three whole days. And I always start by saying, how would you like to be treated?
Yeah.
How would you like to? And the three things, I mean, lots of things come up.
Yeah.
But consistently in every school, no matter what age group, no matter what socioeconomic, yeah. whatever, yeah. right? It's fairness, equality, and respect.
Yeah.
Then sometimes you get honesty
yeah.
and fun and other things. Yeah. But those key yeah. things always come up. I mean, they're core human values. They're yeah. core needs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what I do is we chart it all up and we make sure that's the list. And then I say, so can I also tell you how I would like to be treated?
Yeah.
And then I put up there, it's usually the same thing, fairness, equality, trust, you know. And then we look at that and then we start saying, so what happens if those things get into competition with each other? So what if I think I'm being honest, but you think that's disrespectful?
Yeah.
How are we going to handle that? And yeah. and I give them the creativity to start yeah. coming up with,
yeah.
and then they come up with crazy ideas, yeah. like you have to do 10 press-ups or something, you know, and it's like, no, that's not really where we're going. But, you know, but it's still the creativity yeah. to start. And then always we come back to, we talk about it.
Yeah.
We just discuss it. We yeah. highlight it. Yeah. in a way that everyone can hear, and then we talk about it. Yeah. And then when we've settled on, so this is how we want to treat each other, and this is how we're going to handle it when it invariably goes wrong, then we sign it. We all sign it, and we leave it up. And then everything I do is measured by that. So if I say then, I need a volunteer for this particular exercise, and six hands go up,
yeah.
I say, oh, I don't know what to do now because
yeah.
you wanted fairness.
Yeah.
So I only need one person for this. And if I pick someone, that might not be fair.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
how do you want to do it? And yeah. they will come up with an answer
yeah,
for me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then what happens is it takes all of that tension out.
Yeah.
So by the end of day one, we're all just
yeah.
cooking together.
Yeah. And that is so different to the you know a standard way of doing yeah. it, which is to apply a set of ground rules to an interaction that you know we've got. There's a course yeah. running today or for the next 3 days, whatever it is. These are my ground rules, and this is what we're going to stick to. So the idea, you know, imposing a set of rules compared to co-creating a way of being is massive. And you pretty much verbatim talked about what we do when we do coaching training courses,
yes,
that you
absolutely.
Do exactly the same thing. And it's something I advocate for teachers in schools to where they have a group that's together. It could be a tutor group, could be a basketball team, it could be the cast of a play or something like that. Like, create that. Like, how are we going to be together?
Mm.
And to this day, I've never had any teacher say to me, oh, I tried that, but my kids took the mickey.
Yeah.
You know, they were just, you know. When you give the genuine, not a token, not a kind of veneer thin, hey, we're all
yeah.
in this together thing.
Yeah, yeah. No,
but
no,
absolutely,
not that at
all. You deeply felt like a total yeah. commitment to this is, they always take it seriously.
Absolutely. And I had one kid once who was, you know, it was definitely like, on the road, gang activity, you know, whatever. And he came into this space and he just wouldn't have it. So he was definitely testing the limits,
yeah, yeah.
which I want him to do. Of
yeah.
course I want him to test the limits. So he said, no, this is just rules. This is just
yeah.
rules dressed up, this meaningless rules dressed up. And he said, I'm not signing it. And I said, okay, well, let's ask everyone else.
Mm.
And I said, you know, how do we feel about you know, not no names, and
yeah.
how do we feel about this young man not signing it? You know, let's talk about it. And then they all got fed up, said, oh, can we just get on with it now? So that's the indicator,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's just get on with it. So I said, so we're essentially agreeing that he can stay here having not signed
yeah,
it,
yeah.
and what we're saying is we're all okay with it because I'm not going to ask him to leave.
Yeah.
I think he's got something really valuable to bring.
Yeah.
And then because that interaction happened,
yeah.
what happened, the very next morning, he came in
yeah.
half an hour early.
Yeah.
We let him in. He went in the room on his own and he signed it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All by himself.
Yeah.
So he just had a delayed reaction.
Yeah, yeah. And that shows that when you truly live what you said you were going to be, and you know, the understandable doubts that some yeah. people have, and they could have prior experience or assumptions yeah. or whatever, then they can be dissipated.
Well, he didn't know me long enough or well enough no. to know whether it was just a whitewash. Yeah. It could have been, couldn't
yeah.
it? It could
yeah,
have been
yeah, yeah,
that that's... 3/4 of an hour yeah. later I'd be yeah. going, well, if you don't do this, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And well, then that's... he would have been
yeah.
right.
Yeah, we've probably both been in events, courses, that sort of thing, where that's been how things have been. So
yes, I'm afraid I've walked out of one or two things in my time.
Yeah. Fascinating. Maria, this has been brilliant. But just you know, to maybe round this all off, how would you summarise neatly for our listeners like the ground that we've covered today and the really clear takeaways that somebody could have?
Okay, let me try and round this up, because that's a really good question. Is AI has its place, and we are going to have to get used to it, love it or hate it or whatever. And I think it could be really good for humanity. I think it can come up with a lot of answers, and it can take us to a really amazing place, but not at a cost to our humanity.
Mm.
And so as much attention as we're paying to learning these new technologies, we need to put even more attention and spotlight on what is it to be human, and how are we going to be together?
Yeah. What does it mean to be human, and how are we going to be together?
Yeah.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as always, that was an absolutely fascinating chat with Maria. Really deep and important issues being raised. And I'm curious, for all of our listeners, what did that make you think of? What does it mean for you to live your life in its most human way? And how might we maximise that across the world? If you found any of these conversations interesting, and I'm sure you have, we're delighted to have Maria coming to work with us next term on the 27th of January. She's doing a session on addressing staff room conflicts. On the 24th of March, another really crucial one on managing relationships with parents. Do get in touch with us at The Bridge if you're interested in taking part in these. Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.